But I'd like to thank all the editors that are, you know, helping out. On the pros, we had Haley Burnett stand up and running. She's awesome to see you. She was the first person to sort of propose the idea of putting Calliope on the internet, so we might have a website with all the art and films and pros up soon, which would be exciting if that happens. But let's begin. I think we got all the stuff. So special thank you to all the people that helped out, especially the teachers, and there's Aaron, art editor.
Yeah.
So a special thanks to everyone who helped out, all the teachers, Donald Hall for being so friendly about us putting this out. And I guess I'll go first, and then we'll start the reading. This poem is called Linear Thinking. In Catholic school, my 8th grade science teacher compared fingerprints to snowflakes, explained DNA as God makes us the same and different. Like certain mornings, the way I notice there is no difference between the ocean and the sky, except for the sound. And each leg is a shuffling movement in my neighbor's garden. The robe reshapes her body against the early dark, each pocket full of soil. The beginnings of a trail from the crease in her hand to the ocean's brim. I can't see it now, but I know it'll be there later when I've reawakened. And this is my last poem, and I wanted to dedicate it to Tim Adams, but I don't think he's here. But yeah, Tim Adams is awesome, and he's leaving soon, and it's going to be sort of a sad thing. This is called PA Turnpike All the Way to New Jersey. I wrote this with Paul Miller on a train into New York. The tree's tilt is perfect along the highway's edge, like a middle school diorama built with hands too precise for an 11-year-old. A mother once dreamed of being an artist. If I disappear into the fog, or the car ahead of me, or a gesture like signs on billboards, or yellow tape with caution school children plastered to a speeding minivan, I might risk finding something else. In mid-March, the grass is still dead, and trees look like models in dressing rooms, the way that I like them. With each burst of light from the insides of a mountain's tunnel, I'm pulled a little closer to what I don't know, and it isn't sad at all. So first up is Daniel Summers. He'll be reading prose. So
I'm gonna read from the beginning of this because it's not the most important part of the story, but it's. It'll make the most sense. This is fine. 3 yucca plants grew against the stone wall. The leaves were long and sharp like Spanish swords reaching to capture the sun's glint. But gentle white flowers towered above the stalks, tiny bells that rung like silk against rock as the wind played them. Adam closed his book and sat up beside the yuccas. He had been reading beneath the shade of the wall and listening to the music of someone on the other side. A haggard old voice pacing back and forth the length of the wall singing. Every so often a rock or clump of clay would sail over the wall, and Adam felt no danger. The thrower had a strong arm and cleared the wall by several yards. The hill leading down to the cottage road, the hill Adam had climbed to reach the wall, was scattered with hay clumps and piles of manure. There had been steer there recently, trucked away to the slaughterhouse most likely. Adam stood, careful to keep Snoop so his newsboy cap wouldn't peer over the wall and give away his presence. "Annie," he whispered. Plucking one of the yucca's white flowers, he made his way down the hill and east through the wire fence that separated the pasture from the road. The bulk was still sitting next to the yucca plants. Adam hoped the farmer with the bad song would find it. He would like a book about China. The road was 13 miles of potholes and breaking asphalt until it joined Route 73, which led to Turkey Hollow, if you went left, and Interstate if you went right. The road was named School Run until you passed the elementary school, which had been closed for countless years, and then the name simply disappeared into the aged nature of back roads. Adam made his way out the nameless stretch. His short fingers played with the yucca bell he had in his pocket, a gift for Annie. The sky seemed translucent. It was almost noon, and the moon was still clearly visible. The clouds hung low in this part of the country. They weren't a part of the sky. They were just distant. When walking toward them, Adam got the impression he would soon run into their cold thickness. He thought maybe he would try it, to feel the sharp air in his lungs and the gray swirl of precipitation clinging to his sky and skin. But for the moment, the sun was warm, the wind was low, and he was walking, happy to be in the open sky. He doubted there would be much green in the cloud. A rusted Geo Metro was winding between potholes and shards of asphalt, making its way toward the fishing trestle across from the Baptist Church, closer to where School Run actually became School Run. As it approached, Adam, its squat frame revealed a man in his mid-60s in a sleeveless flannel coat. Because of his broad shoulders and a long gray beard, he looked crammed into the little vehicle. The Geo slowed to a stop in the middle of the road. The car's rear wheel settled into a deep pothole, giving the driver a slanted appearance. "Don't know that I would like to be walking today," the driver said. "The air is hotter than hell, but the wind's colder than a witch's tit. Hell, it's colder than a wife's tits." Adam laughed. "Strange weather." "Well, I'm riding in style. You need a lift?" Adam looked up toward the black curves of road and the endless thickets and farms. "No. But thanks. I like walking. Exercise." "Uh-huh. Well, exercise, eat right, die anyway. That's my philosophy." The driver stroked his beard. And the idle of the Geo's engine began to shake violently. "Damn sardine can on wheels is what this is." He slammed a massive fist against the dash. The idle became worse. "Listen, you don't happen to know if the Pizza Perfect out on old 73 still carries bait, do you? Normally I get my own, but it's this weather, too cold for me." "I don't know. Sorry," Adam said. "Well, I'll try it. I'd hate to drive all the way out to Walmart. Hell, maybe I'll try corn or something." "Corn's really good for trout. They can't resist it," Adam said. "Yeah, you dip some corn in sweet anus and they jump right up in the bank for you. Trouble is, I'm channel cats. I'm after channel cats. Maybe even a drum. Not sure if you can eat anything out of this damn river anymore." "Soap." "What's that?" "You put dish soap on the ground, and night crawlers come up out of the ground and dries them out somehow. I used to do it when I was a kid. You can get dozens." "Huh. Imagine that," he said. You sure you don't need a lift? I don't know where you're going, but it's gotta be far. There ain't shit on this road." "I'm sure. Thank you." "All right. Take care." The driver waved. The heavy jerk, the Geo pulled its worn tire out of the pothole, and the rusted, broken car sputtered into the distance. "But hit those clouds," Adam thought. Thank you.
I bet you it might go home to sleep, boys.
I just want to thank the people that worked on poetry staff with Keegan and I. And thank you for coming down to the end of High Street and all the snow for our meeting. And I didn't like it, but proud of what we got done. And since this is the Calliope reading, I'll read the poems in the book. and it's called Ravine. There's a ravine behind my house, I noticed today, after months of squatting here. It's hidden by a tree line, whose greens have yellowed and declined. Through the winter gaps, I can see the way the earth drops off. Gravel grinds under my boots on approach. I take a seat on a cold stone to look down for the first time. The Mohegans have a practice field there. The boys are dressed in blue. They navigate each other around the grass, using full contacts and Hail Marys, making gaps in the defensive line. From my rock, I voyeurize the production until the coach rounds up the boys, the post-practice huddle. Their orange heads dip for a communal prayer. The title of this poem has been eluding me for like 2 weeks now. I absolutely have no idea what to call it, and it's bugging me. So what I have right now is title in caps, an exclamation point, a question mark, then a colon, and a boy and his dog. So that's what it's going by tonight. Anyway. I sat beside Mother, kitchen chairs turned toward the electric stove, the Christmas star glowing blue above the burners. She read to me from the Precious Moments Bible, the story of the Lamb. On Christmas Eve, Father brought Broadway home. The Bichon Frise pranced into the living room, a red ribbon stuck in the white puppy-cut hair of his head. He rolled on the Berber carpet so I could rub his belly. When the blizzard of 91 hit Moundsville, snow piled up, level with a small stone square of our front porch. Broadway was let out to do his business, walked off the porch, disappeared, directly into the soft powder. I ran for help, screaming through the house. I cried in terror, fearing the worst for the little dog, who emerged, white snow clumped in off-white hair, safe in Father's hands. As I grew up, my friend aged. His coat began to thin. Cataracts formed on his eyes. A nail broke down past the quick. Mother and I rushed him to urgent care, bleeding. Mother prayed for him. I could no longer pray. I simply looked into his distant eyes, asking him to stay, just a little longer. For the next few weeks, Broadway limped, a bandage on his paw, if only they made crutches for dogs. On November 17th, 2004, I saw Broadway panting wildly, tongue flailing out of his mouth. He pushed under the couch to be alone. When I left for school, I knew I wouldn't be with him when the end came. My MFA mentor, it was weird to use hair when talking about a dog, but they actually do have hair, not fur. Interesting. There's like two breeds, Bichon's one of them, I don't know what the other one is. Anyway, yeah. Okay. This one got a few cheap laughs last night before 18 reading, so I figured I'd share it with those of you who weren't there. It's called, "Excuse Me, God, Can I Get Alan and Hunter's Contact Info?" I wonder what it was like recreating the music of Fitzgerald, sweet clacks pressing steel to ribbon to paper, the celestial ding waiting at the end of each line, like a rainbow's pot of gold. Going through the motions can provide a measure of comfort. Listening, the rhythm of my plastic keys bouncing off the gelatinous contact pad below, sending electric impulses through the universal serial bus. The times huck on soft. New age writers hide inside their hipster gear, sipping $4 lattes, fondling their laptops, getting off on the exhibitionism of it all. Relationships are defined by Facebook status. Getting to know people is out of date. We just need a profile picture and a Twitter address. I want to go back to when acid mattered. When a student could fuck a stranger at a party without having the pictures be on the net by noon. When we could sit around the fire in the woods, naked and high, swapping partners, chanting Hare Rama, Hare Rama. In the age of constant connection, we're all marionettes fighting over the strings. Pen down. And this will be my last one for today. It's sort of tapping into that dialogue with the dead that Blumenthal was talking about in his reading, which I thought was interesting. It's called What I Would Like to Say to Sexton. And I come to feel left out, like a page watching the joust. When you celebrate the things I will never know, why must I feel guilty to celebrate what makes me a man? Can I not revere my species' potential? The elegant redundancy of tiny soldiers racing towards the holy goal of their existence. I open doors for my desire. She thinks I'm saying, you are incapable of opening doors for yourself. I only wanted to tell her, I would open 1,000 doors to make you love me. Thank you.
The next reader is Eileen Funk.
Hello. I just wanted to quickly thank the creative writing faculty that I've had a chance to work with and the Calliope staff members that put this together because it looks fabulous. And Keegan Lester for harassing me to submit something, which I did, and voila. So this is actually the introduction of my capstone piece that I read the conclusion of last night at the 418 reading. So if you were there, you got the conclusion, and now you have the introduction. Okay. You can't sell her, plain and simple, I won't let you. I stared down at the ground and jammed the toe of my boot into a nettle that had somehow managed to grow up through the many layers of gravel my brother shoveled onto the barn path. I crushed the weed, twisting my black Ariat for good measure. She goes, Eileen, I'm not keeping that horse through the winter. Why not? I know the answer before he spits it out. So your stupid cows will have to share their hay? You said you wanted a few cows, remember? Dad, do you know what the recognized definition of a few is? No one told you to send them to Custer's and get them all bred. It's your fault we're not going to have enough to feed everybody. A dusty breeze chills the sweat beating on my forehead. This is the part where I start to lose the argument every time, but I try just the same. Maybe sooner or later, he'll get tired of bringing the subject up. No, I'm selling that pinhead animal because she's worthless. Nobody does anything with her. Worthless. I ride her. She's a good trail horse. My father is a businessman during the weeks and a farmer on the weekends. I can tell he's losing interest in our conversation. He's made up his mind, but he's still looking for permission. I watch as he tamps the ground around the tilted hitching post. The half-rotten cedar crumbles, but he insists on a 90-degree angle. Crooked posts are non-functional. You never did that much with her. You never took her to shows. He blurts out a wrong assumption. Besides, she never lets anyone catch her. I feel my face contort, jaw tighten, ears burn. I focus on the crippled nettle instead of his glaring eyes. She comes to me. She wouldn't be so spooky if you didn't chase them into the dry lot at night on that stupid dirt bike of yours. I blink up and see his mouth forming a sneer. That means he knows I'm right, but he knows how to counter. I contribute to the post straightening by kicking more gravel at the base for him to pound down on. Maybe if I help, he'll drop this and table it to later. She pulls and flips out when she ties. She's dangerous. I should have got rid of her when she hurt Mom. I contemplate. He has a point. She did mess up Mom's thumb with that pulling habit. More gravel. Thud, thud, thud. Mom isn't careful. You should never fully trust an animal, any animal. She's worthless, and she's going to sale next Friday. There's an auction at Thurmont. I wasn't aware that this time he had plotted out an exact date of my horse's departure. The weed suffers the brunt of my wrath as I try to annihilate it. Thurmont, Maryland. He would send her there, where the Amish would see the appeal of her black form and curved neck. My horse, the perfect buggy horse. Smart on his part. She'll go for a good price there. 1,000 thoughts race in my mind. The Amish wouldn't be kind to her. She'll work until she drops, which, considering her age... No. Say no. Get angry. I vent. You just hate her because she's the only horse you've never been able to work with. My words are hot and sharp as they escape my mouth. You're going to sell my horse because she hurts your pride. I lift my gaze from the tattered weed. The thudding ceases. Dad's eyes look particularly squinty this time. I could tell that the next words out of his mouth were going to be the end to this roundabout argument, that we had during the duration of the summer. My stomach sinks as he gives his ultimate blow. She goes, or that red devil of yours goes. We can't feed all of them, and you don't need two horses. My stomach sinks. His eyes are serious. This is no bluff. The red devil he is referring to is my first horse, a chestnut cob who never misses an opportunity to give my father grief. In my mind, I can still see him standing in his stall at the horse dealer's ranch, head proud and eager to please his new 12-year-old mistress. I can see us going to our first show and walking out of the gate with a red ribbon, both our heads high, my face a pure picture of ecstasy. I replay each fair, each reserve championship, and then our final year there receiving a regal purple sash emblazoned with the words Grand Champion. I stare out into the field to the water trough. I see my childhood companion dip his head into the algae-lined tank and part his velvet lips over the water's surface. His summer coat is slick and golden. His ears still respond by pricking up as I deliver a low whistle. My heart breaks at the thought of him being cut out of my life. I turn back to him now, my hard-headed father, a man who so flippantly places worth on an animal based on its purpose and use. He does not believe in sentimentality when it comes to two pasture retirees. They are not friends. They are not family. They are hay hoarders when they could be cash in his pocket. There is only one answer to give. I will suffer from my betrayal to her, but I will not be a Brutus to him. I give Dad the response he expects. All right, I'll let her go.
Next up, we have Tyler Chadwell.
I want to take a real quick second to thank everybody as well, the Calliope staff. Haley was a great editor, so was Keegan, and the creative writing staff that I worked with. I wrote this in Natalie's class originally, and Professor Sackett's class originally. And it's actually a second-person warrior model, although, I mean, just the fact that it's second-person. And everyone else, I have to thank you. You know who you are because you were here tonight and instrumental in everything I've done. And even though this piece is written in humor, it's a very serious subject, so please, if you feel like you might kill yourself, talk to somebody. I find that underpaid creative writing staff members are perfect because you don't have to pay them and they listen to anything. So, excuse my language. Don't be a pussy. If you're going to kill yourself, you need to follow through with it, or else you'll just be a whiny little faggot grappling in detention with a fake attempted suicide. This pretty much puts you in the same category as a 13-year-old girl's. Suicide is not something you think of on a daily basis. You didn't spend your whole life fantasizing about how you kill yourself. You read an article about it, about how suicides were prevalent in certain seasons, the season you were in, and you happen to be experiencing your own season of discontent. This article causes you to consider suicide, and because it was already on your mind, you noticed the statistics on gay suicides all across the country. You make a plan, a meticulous, detailed plan of how you will end your life, the steps you will follow to make it happen. You will get out your paper with the rainbow in the background, take out your favorite pen, and begin planning. Step 1, start cutting off the ties that bind. If you see your friends or family, you will become nostalgic and optimistic and will say, your life isn't horrible, you have friends and a family, but no lover. No boyfriend who loves you or even likes you or even thinks of someone else while he fucks you. You are alone. You are allergic to animals and no one wants to help you spawn a child, so you are living a life out of a well-decorated, empty apartment that sees few guests. You have tried to be the perfect friend, son, lover, and boyfriend, but this is not good enough. You cook culinary-style meals and decorate meticulously. You throw great dinner parties and open your home and your wallet to any friend or acquaintance in need. You are so fucking desperate for people to like you, you are like a Labrador puppy, scrambling about them to please them in any way you can. If you make a wrong step, say the wrong word, lick their face. With too much exuberance, and they turn on you. Disgusted by your body and the idea that you would take advantage of them by treating them as a sexual being, even though they spend 99% of their time working to make themselves the most beautiful creatures on God's earth. God knows they think they are hot, but you are their friend, and you're not supposed to think they're hot. Just tell them how good they are, how good they look when you see them. That's all. So hard as it may be, stop calling home every day and asking your mother how she is. Do your best to avoid your friends without making it appear as though you are angry. Step 2, decision time. How do you want to die? Nothing too painful, that way you're less likely to wimp out. That eliminates drowning, death by fire, death by gay bashing, and hanging. You try to be a neat person, so anything too messy is out of the question. You don't support the NRA and have never been a big fan of guns, so shooting yourself won't fly. Plus, if you did it wrong, you could end up hurting yourself and being stuck with a deformity. You could overdose, but you heard that referred to as the coward's way out, plus one stomach pump and you're back to square one. So you feel as though slitting your wrists will be the way to go. To keep the mist down, you'll do it in the bathtub like you've seen it done on TV. Step 3, get your supplies. You need a blade sharp enough to do the job. You decide a box cutter from Lowe's is exactly the way to go. You get extra blades just in case. You buy some pretty stationery and new wax to seal your envelopes with. You buy a few impulse presents, one for your mother and one for your best friend. When you get home, your ex calls you and wants to hang out, which means he wants to fuck your brains out. You are lonely and vulnerable and foolishly agree. You shower and put scented lotion on your skin. You light candles and put some soft music on. When he shows up, he looks as though he's come straight from work, no shower from him. You answer the door in nothing but sexy underwear, and he smiles at you with a wolfish grin. His eyes don't hide the hunger he has for your body. He smiles again when he sees the candles and hears the music. You are so romantic, he tells you, as though this was a silly girl thing to be. In minutes, you are on the bed, the carefully selected underwear tossed aside, unnoticed by him. He fucks you with a passion that steals your breath and stains your satin bed sheets. His cum pools on your stomach and cools quickly. You do your best to catch the runoff, trying desperately to save your sheets. He gets up gingerly. He is one of those annoying people who feels energized by sex instead of sleeping slow like you do. He goes to take a piss, and when he comes back, he begins to dress. That was great, he tells you. I have to be up early tomorrow, and he's gone. You're alone once more with the romantic scent of melting wax and the easy melodies of cool border. Yet alone, these sounds and smells make you feel sick. The candles have made your bedroom too warm, and your sheets are too sticky to sleep in, so you'll have to change them before bed. You will also have to take yet another shower to scrub away the lonely reminder he left congealing on your belly. Step 4, time to write. Because you love the people in your life more than they love you, you want to write them letters telling them how much you love them and how this isn't their fault. How you look after them from the grave beyond, wherever that may be. You write a special letter to your mother, taking special care to tell her she was a great mother and this isn't her fault. Even if it kind of is, she doesn't need to know that. Each letter is carefully handwritten on beautiful, expensive stationery. When you're finished, you place them in the proper envelopes, address and stamp them. You get out your favorite wax seal and new wax and seal the envelopes with a sense of pride. Your mother calls you to make you feel guilty for being so distant, and you cry after you hang up. Step 5, clean house. Clean your apartment within an inch of its little life. Scrub the floors, clean out the fridge, clean the oven, dust. Gather all your sex paraphernalia into a cardboard box. At your age, you have about a lube, condoms of various sizes and shapes and flavors, butt plugs, vibrators, dildos, a ball gag, anything that could be construed as bondage gear, a paddle you got for your last birthday, a shot glass that looks like a penis, porn in various forms, whether it be photos or videos. When you've gathered all this up, donate it to a kindred queer who has never seen half the stuff, and if you're lucky, show him how to use a few of them. In short, get rid of anything that would make your dad turn red or your mother cry once you were dead and they were cleaning your things out. Step 6, the final countdown. Mail your letter, pay your bills. Even in death, you shudder the thought of bad credit. Since it is your last day of work, tell your boss what you really think of him and then quit. That way you can't change your mind when you go home and go on as though you never considered it. Before you make it home, your best friend calls and asks if you'd like to go shopping. You love shopping, and death can wait a few more hours. So you go and have a blast. Your friend tells you that you seem distracted and you wave them off. When you return home, you reconsider for a moment. You had such a good time, maybe your life isn't so bad. Then you glance at the empty side of your bed. You never have to make the other side because you don't toss and turn too much, and the bed is big and empty like your apartment. You take 2 pills with a glass of wine to calm your nerves and get up your resolve. Step 7, death. You fill your large tub with hot water. You place the box cutter on the ledge, already soaked in alcohol. You're not sure why, because getting an infection would be the least of your problems soon. You put your clothes in the dirty clothes hamper. Naked, you sneer at your reflection in the mirror. You hate your body. Not in the false, ridiculous way that your hot friends say, "Oh, my stomach is so poosh," or the way they complain about tiny little imperfections that you can never see. Your body is hideous, and you know it, and many men have told you so, if not with words, then with their lack of interest. The water is almost too hot to bear when you climb in. You ball your hands into fists and let your wrists soak in the heat. Let your blood boil to the surface. You begin to think about all the people you love. You bring images of your friends to your mind, their beautiful bodies, the way you love to hold them and cuddle them close, the way they never really loved you back. Sadness seeps into your body like a cold. You are too empty to cry, so empty that you don't even flinch when you make the first deep ruby slice down the road, not across the highway. As you repeat the process on the other arm, you think of God and wonder if he exists. If he does exist, you wonder about heaven, what rules really apply. You wonder if committing suicide will exempt you from heaven or if loving men will. You bleed and bleed and you feel a numb coldness overtaking your body. Then the bathwater is crimson with your life spilling into it. You ball your hands into fists, then release and try to squeeze as much blood as you can. You hope the cuts aren't healing or scabbing over. You hope they are deep enough. You die alone in a tub of rapidly cooling water. Or you don't.
Up next is Brandy Hooper.
This poem actually came about from an assignment given to me by Maggie Glover, who was my 213 teacher last year. I've done about 4 revisions of this since I submitted it to Calliope, so it's kind of interesting to be reading the older version. Kind of like an old friend, I guess. This is God at the Fruit Stand. Every time I spend a dollar, I cross off your name. It offends me to see it, like faith is something we can trade for California oranges on a hot highway shoulder. When I was 9, Sister Sandra cut an apple in half and said that your story was there, in a circle of seeds. I almost believed her, except fragile flesh, rigid core, small, round infants deep inside, and a skin speckled brown with the sun. An apple is the fruit of a mother. You can burn a bush or part a sea, but you can never know how it feels to grow a universe, to feel him curled asleep in your middle, pressing your hand from inside, to weep and curse and part like the sea to bear him. How can I trust you with eternity when you've never felt agony in creation, never risked your existence for the sake of bringing forth? How can I do anything but cross you off every time I spend a dollar and buy a roadside orange?
And up next is Jay Deshaies.
Hi, I'd like to thank my fellow editors and everyone who was on Calliope's staff. I also would like to thank everyone who thinks it looks pretty for appreciating the aesthetics, as well as the content. I'm going to read 4 poems because my mother wasn't reading last night and I have a few for her. So I'll read the one in Calliope first. And the other ones are short, so it's not going to be taking epic lengths of time or whatever. But anyway, this is called The Tenth. You say creativity peaks at age 25. You're 23 with a guitar. I'm 20 with pen and paper, hunched in your yellow armchair as you sit cross-legged on the floor, plucking your instrument strings. Between chord changes, you say, I am your muse, somewhere between melopamine and alcohol. I can be your lunatic screaming in the street, something about communication, feelings and the need for communication. But you speak a different language. I don't know the verbal equivalent of D minor, but I get the meaning behind that note, just as you can't translate the physical sounds when I say Yamoyarushka. But you understand what I just said. I know it's good when the melody's pretty. Nothing gets lost in translation between that chair and the floor because end products speak for us. I could say you've been my muse, somewhere between erotio and loneliness, a brother among 9 sisters, and me. When I scratch sharp words on my paper, what do you feel? Is it the same prideful swell I get in the pit of my chest when you bend a note for me? Or does your smile hide a certain sadness because you only have 2 years left and I have 5, if you're right? Not my best reading that poem, but whatever. It's the spirit of the reading that matters. This one's for my mother. It's called Mother the Blue Sweater, and I read it last night, but I'm reading it again because she wasn't there, and now she is. Mother the Blue Sweater. The first thing my mother does for herself of evenings is exchange work slacks and a white bra for a pilled Chanel house sweater, still jewel blue after years of heavy washing. She blames me for why her breasts sag, flat and empty on her freckled chest, her nipples ragged because you chewed. And even though she'll quickly blame me for her extra pounds and why she's too broke to buy a new sweater and a Wonder Bra, she'll remind me that I am her miracle in a voice so hushed and sweetly maternal that her words are almost overpowered by the dull hum of traffic on Route 220 driving along the curves in the Appalachians. Right? This is my dog poem, and it definitely won't be Micah's, because, you know, dead pets, you really can't solve that. I empathize with you, okay? My mom's died this week, so I'm it's called On High Street, Morgantown, West Virginia. The old dog's name might be Max or Rudy or just Good Boy. He walks only inches from the sidewalk with deliberate care, ahead of his age master every day from noon to one. New air is vital for dogs and humans. At the stoplight, he labors to crouch down far enough to straighten the collar, releasing several thick kinks. The skin over the man's hands pulls taut as he completes the adjustment. A tarnished silver name tag hangs underneath the dog's chin. The point of a reddened tongue sticks perfectly straight from his happy, panting mouth. The man smiles down at his dog with subtle dignity as he leans easily on a polished wood cane. The dog's small head bobs slightly side to side in time with his stubby tail, waiting till it is safe to lead his master upward and around the corner. And this is my final poem, which is half fictitious. It's called Able Garden. Tentatively, it's called Able Garden. The dogwood tree still blooms outside. Bright leaves reflect on the quarter window of the bedroom where my grandmother died after the fireworks last July. My grandfather doesn't plant tomatoes anymore. He grows pansies now, each blossom shaped like a heart. She voted for Nixon only because he voted for Kennedy. Grandfather stopped going to church when she found God for the third time. But they spent all Saturday in the vegetable garden, pulling crabgrass up by the root and picking beetles from the red fruit. Purple flowers remind grandfather of her because she wore a violet hat in the afternoon sun. He doesn't really remember her favorite flower. After 43 years of marriage, it would have been foolish to ask. As he digs tiny holes in the topsoil, he mutters, "Barnes, you better like these." Thank you, and thank you for supporting me.
It's called Perennials. About my father and me and my son or his son. Rain, the railroad, almost for Scythia beginning to bloom. Twin bicycle to the exit. Greenhouse dirt spires in the tub. Sweat, the riverbank at night. Ghost stories, the trailer in the mountains. Family faces half lit by the campfire. Glass bottle drinking, fireworks. And this one belongs to the rats in the AM radio. 3 a.m. on 95 South to Georgia, a bag full of cash under the seat, growing up too fast. Flannel shirts, basketballs pound against the hardwood, picking pansies for dead wounds. Kissing her on the couch and stopping for the footsteps. Football games. Berkeley Fair. Bare trees, long fingers scrape ice from the windshield, paint stains from muddy snow. Looking for presents Christmas morning, toy gun behind the door, bike behind the curtains. Dimly lit vestibules, 50 hymns form a home. Crack voices lifted in the night. Back from college, watching your father slowly age. Dogwood petals fill the streets. Thanks.
And for our last reader, I'm going to give a shout out to all the other people that were on the staff, like Jared Martin and Jessica Murphy and Jared Jones and John Morris, Mary Goodson, Sarah Roper, Christina Pelling, Marie Pellegrino, Marshall Burns, Dwight Pavanik, and Aaron Long. Thank you all for your help. And this last reader tonight is Anthony Hebegatori. So.
That Velvet Underground song. Oh, this tune makes me think about fucking in the library. It's noisier than white television, but I'm not talking not in here about what goes on in headphones, group study rooms, or these sallow staircases. It's in the stacks, hushed between Sartre and Shakespeare. Lean into a sigh, and I'll stare at a sign that reads, "Do not restock books." Always worrying, wondering if the nearby curve of computers and students is listening in between Facebook pressing F5, refreshing, Googling pictures of circles and car crashes, killing time between classes. I think too much, but I love it when you say it's like what you said you read in that book and trail off. So whisper it into that row of black cloth covered Kafka and tell me again about that time I told you about death, 80s Hades, a blind man's philosophy. And I'll deconstruct the history of your sexuality until the librarian reminds us to shut up, quiet, please drop everything and read. I'm gonna read one more. This is discarded. Red flutter on the stark gray sidewalk in the morning haze, the hangover, the lucid dawn. The sun rises in the grosbeak's throat. This bright young ball of feathers is a boy with broken wings. Raised in West Virginia, I know my sexual dimorphism. He is a king, crimson like a rustic sweater, and his women are ugly. He forgets about all that. He tries to fly, but he is in a mime's cage, a marionette with two clipped strings, dancing aimless. The northern cardinal can't remember his own directions. He is damned to haunted pavement. The natural aviary of this atmosphere makes no accommodation for the handicapped. Stray cat breakfast waiting, nearly paralyzed, dread. So I step on his head. We both hear bones breaking like the crunch of frozen snow. A moment of hesitation, my tread in his face keeps him alive, so I have to stamp two more times. In lieu of an elegy, I pluck the crisp seashell of a cracked beak from the bottom of my shoe. Despite Mrs. Bennett and her elementary warnings, never play with dead feathers as birds carry lice. Instead of parasites, I think about his soft, warm corpse in my palm. My first kill, I guess, unless you count insects. As I cradle this fractured skeleton the size of a hand grenade, I imagine him trembling. Thank you.
So, thank you all for coming out, and we have to chip some cookies and water. So, and make sure to pick up some books because there's a lot of them, and I've got these really small arms that are not good at picking boxes. So, please take some home. Thank you very much for coming out.